From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As President Clinton gives the Commencement Day address at MIT, we'll talk to the parents of a former MIT student, Lori Berenson. She sits in a Peruvian jail. Then, a discussion with Margaret Randall, the feminist author, about the sex abuse allegations against former Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega. And a look at the largest merger ever in the pharmaceutical industry, Monsanto and American Home Products. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Calling him an enemy of the Constitution, a federal judge yesterday sentenced Terry Nichols to life in prison without the possibility of parole for conspiring to bomb the Oklahoma City Federal Building. In passing sentence after hearing from survivors of the blast and relatives of some of the 168 people who died in it, the judge, Richard Mache of Federal District Court, said this was not a murder case, adding it's a crime and the victims have spoken eloquently here, but it is not a crime as to them so much as it is a crime against the Constitution of the United States. That's the victim. Nichols was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter in those deaths, and yesterday was given the maximum sentence of 6 years in prison for each to run concurrently with his life sentence. He was also acquitted of actually committing the bombing. While the conspiracy charge carried a possible death sentence, the jurors need to vote unanimously for such punishment, and they could not do so. The sentencing then fell to the judge. The Supreme Court delivered a swift rebuff yesterday to Kenneth Starr's effort to short-circuit the ordinary appellate process and get a quick ruling from the justices on disputed claims of privilege for four grand jury witnesses. The court said in two brief orders issued without dissent that it would not grant expedited hearings or indeed any hearings at all at this stage on the scope of the attorney-client privilege for White House lawyers or on the existence of a previously unrecognized protective function privilege for Secret Service agents. Sidney Blumenthal's to testify again before the Whitewater grand jury in Washington. The presidential aide had previously refused to answer certain questions on grounds of executive privilege, but the White House withdrew that claim this week. This news from Jakarta. Student protesters pulled down an American flag at a U.S. consulate and tore it to protest American interference in Indonesian affairs. At the consulate in Surabaya, Indonesia's second-largest city, several dozen students rallied for several hours. One protester climbed a fence and replaced an American flag inside the compound with a red and white Indonesian flag. Demonstrators outside the consulate reportedly then trampled and tore the U.S. flag. A right-wing death squad killed 25 people and torched their bodies after kidnapping them 3 weeks ago in northeast Colombia. This, according to the government's top peace commissioner. Jose Rios said a nationwide paramilitary alliance known as the United Self-Defense Group of Colombia admitted in a communique that it slaughtered the men after convicting them of being Marxist rebels in a mock trial. The corpses have not been recovered. This news from South Africa. Archbishop Desmond Tutu says he considers apartheid evil, but denies that South Africa's Truth Commission, which he chairs and which has taken former President P.W. Botha to court, was biased. Argument about the morality of apartheid raged at the trial, where Botha is charged with contempt for refusing to testify before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission over claims his government endorsed gross human rights violations. Botha's attorneys, who earlier had failed to block evidence by an apartheid assassin who said the former hardline president had given orders for civilian bombings, sought to prove that the commission's official probe into past atrocities was not even-handed. This news from Hong Kong. 9 years after Chinese troops massacred hundreds of students demonstrating for democracy in Beijing's Tiananmen Square, tens of thousands of people gathered to commemorate those who died. And in a dramatic show of opposition to the closed political system on the mainland, the rally was addressed by some of the most outspoken critics of the central government in Beijing, exiled dissidents Wei Jingsheng and Wang Dun, speaking from the United States, and labor activist Han Dongfeng. In the past, Chinese leaders have warned against Hong Kong being used as a base of subversion against mainland China. Beijing Freed Wei and Wang Dan in the run-up to President Clinton's visit to China later this month. Mexican justice officials reportedly released all but 16 of the 167 people in a massive early morning raid on their Chiapas village yesterday. Officials said the raid was peaceful, but TV pictures showed police beating people and firing tear gas. No survivors were reported in the crash of a helicopter carrying most of Indonesia's senior military commanders in East Timor. Officials said the craft struck treetops in a heavy rain, killing 12 generals and colonels and their pilot. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy. And since I was last here, we had some problems there in Russia with the financial crisis there, and the United States having to come in and try to bail out once again, or promise to bail out Russia. And I began wondering, what if it turns out that a capitalist Russia becomes responsible for a financial crisis that impacts on the United States, and the capitalist Russia ends up doing what the Soviet Union could never do, which was bring down the U.S. financial system? It would be an amazing irony, wouldn't it?
It would be quite incredible. And speaking of banks, the U.S. Congress is still deciding whether to approve loans to approve giving more money to the IMF for the bailing out of Indonesia, although the World Bank has already decided to do that to some extent. I also thought it was interesting, the news report I just read on the students in Indonesia bringing down the U.S. flag, because I remember being there in 1994 when President Clinton visited Suharto, not to mention President Clinton visiting some of his campaign contributors, the Riyadis in Indonesia at the time. And at that time, Timorese students jumped over the wall of the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta. It was an amazingly brave act because many of them were taken into custody, but others made it and sought the refuge of the embassy. At the time, there were reports in the corporate networks here in the United States that said that it wasn't that they were targeting the U.S. It was that it was just the nearest wall and they wanted to jump one, once again obscuring the relationship that the Indonesian and Timorese students know well between the United States and the criminal reign of Suharto.
Well, those U.S. embassy walls overseas are pretty low these days. You know?
That's right. Well, we're going to turn to another international issue right now. In March, former Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega's stepdaughter, Zoila Merica Ortega, shocked the world and the progressive community in the United States with allegations that the Sandinista leader had sexually abused and raped her repeatedly throughout her childhood. She received no personal response to the accusations from Ortega personally. In mid-April, Zoila Merica held a news conference announcing she would take legal action against Ortega. During the conference, she asked that Ortega renounce his parliamentary immunity so as not to put the FSLN, the Sandinista party, in a difficult position. She ended her press conference by saying, "I call upon all women that have suffered and continue suffering abuses and aggressions to accompany me in this struggle for us. Since we have truth on our side, we are not alone." Zoila Merica's accusations have sparked a flurry of letters from Nicaragua solidarity groups in the United States calling for accountability from the former president. One of those who wrote an open letter to the FSLN is Margaret Randall. Margaret Randall lived in Nicaragua for 4 years. She's a longtime Sandinista solidarity activist. She's a feminist author of more than 80 books. She wrote the book Sandino's Daughters and Sandino's Daughters Revisited, and also wrote a book about her own survival of incest. And we welcome Margaret Randall to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, it's good to be with you. Why don't we start at the beginning when it first broke this year, what Zoila Merica's story was. Zoila Merica is the oldest daughter of Daniel Ortega.
Zoila Merica is actually his stepdaughter. She's the oldest daughter of Rosario Murillo, who is the woman who lives with Daniel. And I believe that Daniel adopted her in 1986. So she's lived with him since she was a child, and he has had the role of father for her, as well as these other roles that we now that have now come to light. But they're actually not related by blood.
And explain the charges against that she is making against the former Nicaraguan president.
Well, at first, she simply said she had been sexually abused by him from the time she was 11 years old until her early 20s. She didn't give many details to begin with, and he came forth with a press conference with his wife at his side and a number of his children, many of his children, actually, and he said nothing. He absolutely refused to respond to her allegations, but Rosario denied them vehemently, and their position was that this was a family matter and should not be aired in public. At the same time as they insisted that it was a family matter and a personal matter, they made it very clear that he was acting as the Secretary General of the FSLN. She, Zoila Medica, has made it clear from the very beginning that she is not accusing him in his position as Secretary General of the FSLN. In fact, Zoila Medica herself is a fairly high-ranking member of that organization and a very active political woman. When he refused to take her allegations seriously, she then went into more detail. And what she is saying is that starting at the age of five, he began to abuse her sexually by touching her and fondling her and other things like that. And then at the age of 11, raped her for the first time and continued to rape her, to abuse her sexually, to force her into sexual acts with other people in his presence. In other words, to really control her in that way, up until the time that she was married. And after her marriage, continued to abuse her telephonically with sexual phone calls and so forth. It was a very terrible situation for her because you had the conflict of this great political leader who is at the same time your father or stepfather. And, you know, he absolutely controlled her life. He actually told her on many occasions, this is part of her declaration to the court a few days ago, that by submitting to his sexual advances, she was helping the revolution.
Hmm. And were there other children? There are other children, and what ages are they? And have any of them been questioned or spoken about this whole situation?
Well, there are a number of other children. I'm not quite sure how many. I think 7 or 8 or 9. Zoila Medica is the oldest. I do not know if any of the other children have been abused. If they know they've been abused, if in the case that they might have been, all but one of them were at the press conference with Rosario and Danielle and were either willingly or being forced to take their parents' side. They didn't come out verbally on one side or another, but their presence at that press conference made it pretty clear that they were assuming that position. I believe one brother has supported Zoila Medica in her accusations, and her ex-husband, Alejandro Bendaña, has come back and stood beside her in this situation and has been very supportive of her as well. And, you know, throughout Nicaragua, of course, there's a great deal of support for Danielle, almost blind support, I would say, because the FSLN, one of the first things it did after this whole thing became public was to refuse to allow anyone in the organization to question or discuss it. And people who have been members of the organization who have wanted to discuss it or question the situation have been disactivated, which is a sort of polite euphemism for being kicked out of the party or suspended. But there are many more people in Nicaragua who, in the party and outside the party, who have heard Zoila Medica's accusations and have felt the rightness, at least of her prerogative in trying to get back her identity as a woman, as a person. And there have been letters, public letters, from the poet Michelle Nachlis, from Gioconda Belli, Sofia Montenegro, from the human rights people in Nicaragua. I read a letter yesterday which moved me almost to tears by a man who is a member of something called Men Against Violence, which is a group in Nicaragua that's been going on for a number of years now, a group of men who are very conscious of the machismo in their society and are working to rid themselves of that.
We're talking to Margaret Randall. Margaret Randall, a Sandinista solidarity activist, author of many books around the Nicaraguan Revolution, as well as Cuba and many other issues, and also wrote about her own story of incest in a book called This Is About Incest. Now, Margaret Randall, you knew Daniel Ortega quite well and actually knew his daughter as well. Your youngest daughter is the same age?
My youngest daughter is close in age to Soy Lamerica. I did not know Soy Lamerica very well, but I did know her. And I didn't know Daniel very well, for that matter, but I certainly knew him before the Sandinistas came to power, as a matter of fact.
So you met him in Cuba?
In Cuba, that's mm-hmm. right.
And then you were in Nicaragua for, 4 years. How old was Soy Lamerica then? And in that circle that you traveled in, was there any talk then when she was a kid?
Soy Lamerica must have been, 13, 14 years old, 15 maybe, when I became conscious with a group of other mothers, actually. We talked among ourselves, I remember at the time, that we knew that something was wrong. It was hard to say exactly what it was, but we knew that there was some abuse of power in her life. And of course, none of us were as aware then as we are today that incest is something that crosses so many cultural and class and ethnic lines. You know, we just didn't think about those things. I didn't remember my own incest until a number of years later. So it wasn't something that sprung to mind in the sense that we could pinpoint it. This is what's wrong. But we were aware of the fact that something was wrong. And I remember quite a few years later, in 1991, I was in Guatemala with a group of women on a political trip. And I ran into one of those mothers who had lived in Nicaragua when I did, and also had daughters, Soy Lamerica's age and the age of my daughter. And we began to talk about this. Now, this was in 1991. By this time, we did know about incest. We had thought about it a great deal. We were much more conscious of the more intimate ways in which patriarchy expresses itself in our societies. And spontaneously, the two of us began to speak of Soy Lamerica. And I remember saying to my friend, Alenka, when is this going to come out? When is this going to become public? And we both said at the same time, well, this is Soy Lamerica's story. It's her story to tell or not, as she decides. And then, obviously, earlier this year, she did decide. I think these things, I think this is a process for women who have suffered this kind of abuse. I know it is from my own history. You begin to remember it, or you begin to come to terms with it if you've always remembered it. And you seek therapy, and slowly you become strong enough to understand that this was not your fault, and this is not something that you have to maintain secret in your life. You can get rid of it, and I think that that's precisely what Soy Lamerica is trying to do.
Margaret Randall, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we're going to come back to this conversation with you. Margaret Randall, a well-known author, author of close to 80 books, a number of them about Nicaragua and Cuba, also one book about her own experience with incest. We're talking about Soy Lamerica Ortega, who is the oldest daughter and stepdaughter of former Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega, and her allegations that her father, Daniel Ortega, abused her throughout her life. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we wrap up our discussion with Margaret Randall, author of a number of books on Nicaragua, lived there for 4 years, talking about these allegations of sexual abuse made by the former Nicaraguan president Daniel Ortega's oldest daughter, Soyla America.
Well, Margaret Randall, it's been my experience with the few people whom I know who have been victims of incest or sexual abuse within the family, that it is extremely difficult to make public charges against the abuser, because obviously it has the potential to tear apart the whole family, all the relationships that have existed previously within that family. So to me, anyone who has come forth publicly, you've got to give them much more than the benefit of the doubt that their allegations have substance, because I know how terribly difficult it is to accuse a father, a stepfather, an uncle, or of this kind of abuse. Could you talk a little bit about that and what the reaction has been in Nicaragua to this?
Well, it is very difficult. You're right. It's horrendously difficult. And I think that people who believe that women make this sort of accusation public as some kind of an attention getter or something like that are just absolutely out of their heads. This is not something that we wish upon ourselves in the first place. I'd like to also just make a plea for people to call Soyla America. Soyla America, not a vice. She has requested, she has said that she is going to legally reclaim the name of her real father, not a vice, and not continue to call her Soyla America Ortega, which links her with her abuser.
He had been an early fighter in the Sandinista Revolution.
That's right, who died before the victory. I think it's very important here to also understand that the Sandinista leaders, Daniel Ortega included, did some extraordinary things. They made extraordinary history. And the problem here is not to throw them out with the bathwater, so to speak, but just simply to realize the strength of patriarchy and how, in spite of the fact that these men contributed tremendously to all our histories, they've simply been unable to internalize that understanding of power into their own lives, because this is not a problem for Daniel Ortega alone. It's a problem on the part of a number of the Sandinista leaders, and indeed of men in many parts of the world who on the one hand are involved in genuine people struggles, but come home then and abuse their wives or daughters or whatever. The other thing that I'd just like to talk about for a minute is what this means in Nicaragua. And I don't think what it means in Nicaragua should be looked at as something just of this moment. I think this is the planting of a seed. I don't think that this is why Soyla America brought the charges. But I think that despite her personal reasons for bringing the charges, this is a seed very much like the seed that was planted by Anita Hill in our own country. Clarence Thomas did indeed become Supreme Court Justice In other words, that battle was not won at the time, but look at how much more attention has been given to sexual harassment in the workplace since the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings. And I think that this is something that is going to be very long-term in Nicaragua and enable people open up a space in which men and women can think about the fact that sexual abuse is not a personal matter. It's a political matter. It has to do with how patriarchy shapes society and shapes all of us. And so I think that the fallout from this, which I see as very positive, I mean, the FSLN had its Congress as planned a week or so ago. Daniel Ortega was reelected Secretary General of the party. In other words, it was business as usual. On the surface, no discussion of this, or as a matter of fact, as far as I can tell, of any substantive issue was discussed during that Congress. On the other hand, this is not going to go away. And so I think that that's sort of the larger perspective that I would like to bring attention to.
Margaret Randall, can you explain what Soilamérica is now asking for, this issue of him to waive his immunity so that she doesn't have to drag the whole FSLN into this?
Well, she has insisted all along that this is not about the FSLN. It's about her stepfather. She is asking him to waive his parliamentary immunity. He is a member of parliament, so that he can be taken to court by her. And she has put in the papers. She has, tried to open the case. She has formally opened a case against him with a 40-page document detailing his abuse of her. For this to go to court, he would have to either waive his parliamentary immunity, or the parliament would have to vote that that his parliamentary immunity be removed for a time so that he can go to court. He shows no willingness for this to happen. So I'm not sure, in fact, that it will go to court at this point.
Again, these are allegations, and that's as far as we know right now, unless this is proved in court. But does she say her mother knew?
She says that her mother did not protect her. And yes, of course, there are allegations. However, there are other witnesses that are not Soilamérica alone. Her ex-husband, Alejandro Bendaña, says, worked very closely with Ortega and worked for many years in the United States representing the FSLN, and has said in public statements, for example, that he would receive a telephone call from Danielle in the morning about some political matter, and on that same telephone line that night, be witness to Danielle calling his wife and making lewd comments or inappropriate sexual innuendos to her. So there are other people. There are a number of friends of hers in whom she confided over the years. It's not simply Soilamérica's word against Danielle's. There does seem to be a community of respected friends and activists and so forth who were quite conscious of what was going on.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Margaret Randall. I know that you've written an open letter on this issue, and if people would like to see that or get more information, where can they perhaps go to on the Internet?
Oh, Amy, I have no idea where it would be on the Internet. It was published in Spanish by El Nuevo Diario, and I believe I heard that the Nicaragua Network in Washington, in one of its bulletins, either published it or published parts of it, but I haven't seen that, so I don't really know.
Well, when we get more information, we'll give it out to our listeners as we follow this story. Margaret Randall, speaking to us from her home in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She herself, a survivor of incest, wrote the book This Is About Incest, and also has written extensively about the Nicaraguan Revolution, the Cuban Revolution, and many other issues. Her latest book is called Hunger's Table. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Right now, we're going to turn to an issue that merged this week, which is the merger of Monsanto and American Home Products. It's the largest deal ever in the pharmaceutical industry. Announced this week that American Home Products would acquire Monsanto Corporation for more than $34 billion. The combined company will be the nation's top seller of prescription drugs. Its brands include such household names as Advil Painkillers, Centrum Vitamins, and NutraSweet. Both companies have been involved with serious health scandals. American Home Products has been flooded with lawsuits from the 6 million people who used its diet drugs Redux and Pondamin, one half of the combination known as Fen-Phen. Analysts now estimate the company's liabilities to be as high as $5 billion. American Home Products is also the producer of Norplant, a very controversial contraceptive that many women have sued over. Monsanto is also known to attempt to suppress any bad press about its products. Most recently, it intervened at Fox Television in Tampa, Florida, to kill a story exposing the negative health effects of bovine growth hormone. Monsanto has also come under fire for its sale of NutraSweet. And we're joined by several people right now to talk about these two companies. James Turner is with us. He's a Washington-based attorney and author of The Chemical Feast, the Nader Study Group report on the Food and Drug Administration. He's worked on food safety issues for 20 years. Ronnie Cummings is with us, national director of the Pure Food Campaign, a public interest advocacy group that focuses on food safety. He's been active in boycott campaigns against Monsanto. And we're joined by Paul Reingold. He's a trial attorney in New York City, and he's taken on the issue of Fen-Phen and the lawsuits that so many people are bringing around the country against American Home Products. Why don't we begin with Paul Reingold, and maybe you can lay out for us American Home Products and its product, Fen-Phen.
Okay, well, I'm happy to do that, Amy. I'm one of many lawyers who are bringing suits against American Home Products and its subsidiaries, Wyeth and Robbins, for people who have had heart valve damage and lung damage from the use of Fen-Phen.
And explain how many people are now suing.
I think the number now is about 4,000 or 5,000. There's no accurate way to count because suits are brought in every state in the country, as well as our federal court system. But people think there'll be 50,000 to 100,000 suits eventually started.
Fen-Phen being the diet drug.
Yes, that's a good explanation. What complicates things is that there were two types of diet drugs out in the market till they were recalled last September. Redux, which is a form of Fen, F-E-N, fenfluramine, that was put out by Wyeth, which is American Home. And then that same company was putting out plain fenfluramine, beginning F-E-N, which was combined by doctors on their own doing with another drug called phentermine. And that's why that other drug cocktail got to be called Fen-Phen.
And what were the negative impacts of these drugs on the people who are suing?
Well, the largest injury, probably 90% of all the suits, are for heart valve damage. The serotonin, which is released by these drugs, has an effect on the heart valves of thickening them and shortening them so that people begin to have regurgitation or backflow from any one of their four heart valves, eventually needing to replacement of the valves with mechanical devices. Another more serious side effect is, fortunately, very rare. It's a form of pulmonary hypertension, which causes constriction of the pulmonary arteries, and it's estimated that 50% of these cases are fatal, no matter what the treatment.
And what effect do you think this merger will have, or this American Home Products acquiring Monsanto? Will it have any effect on these suits?
I would predict it'll have no effect whatsoever. You could say, well, now I have Monsanto assets behind this, as well as their considerable assets. But on the other hand, if you buy a company, you have that much less of your own stock because you've given it up to the new stockholders. So the markets felt that the capital value of American Home, even before this merger, was around $60 billion. And if you took your figure of $5 billion, which is about as wild an estimate as anyone can make because no one really knows, and consider insurance, there should be no problem for this company to pay off on these claims.
I'd like to bring in James Turner into the conversation. The public, over the last couple of years, has been deluged with new drug products. It seems almost every day there's a new one that comes that's being announced on the evening news. What is going on with the FDA, for instance, in terms of this fenfen, in terms of being able to do sufficient study of the long-term effects of these drugs to root out these kinds of problems?
Well, first of all, the FDA does no studies. The FDA only reviews studies done by the companies, and often it only reviews not exactly summaries, but the company's presentation of what they've studied. Toward the end of the 80s, the GAO did a review of FDA approvals in the 80s and found that approximately 50% of the new uses that were approved by the FDA had to be withdrawn subsequently. That's 50% of new uses added on to drugs that were already on the market. This is all a legacy of the deregulation that went through the federal government and the FDA during the 1980s. I think it's been a very, very weak screen for keeping people safe from new pharmaceuticals or new devices.
James Turner, you yourself have been extremely active on NutraSweet, which is everywhere now.
Well, yes, I have. Actually, you said I was involved in this for 20 years. It's actually been 30 years. In 1970, some researchers drew to my attention serious problems with aspartame, which is the name of NutraSweet scientifically. And they pointed out, this is in animal studies, they pointed out that it caused small holes in the brain and created some other side effects that were problematic. Based on that, I objected to the use of NutraSweet in 1974 when it was first approved, and we were able to keep it off the market and, in fact, get a public board of inquiry at FDA to rule that it should not be marketed based on the fact that it had caused cancer in animal studies. This ruling was in October of 1980, 1 month before the 1980 election. In February of 1981, Ronald Reagan appointed Arthur Hall Hayes commissioner, and the first decision he made was to overturn his public board of inquiry. And then the last decision he made 2 years later was to allow NutraSweet to go into soft drinks. The first decision was for dry foods. This entire display pushed NutraSweet into the market, and then 1985, Monsanto bought it, and from then on, it has just been a drumbeat of trying to spread this as far and as deep as possible in the American diet. I don't think it's been really as successful as they intended. Still, with all of the information and so forth, still, I don't believe more than half of the American public actually uses it. We have a fairly large resistance to it. There are about 30 websites that are attacking NutraSweet on an ongoing basis, and it's been an interesting thing to watch from a grassroots point of view. At one point, 30% of the public said in polling that they opposed NutraSweet, which is extraordinary for what is basically a marginal food additive in terms of its actual role in people's lives.
Ronnie Cummings, you too have been working on Monsanto for many years, but you've been working on a different one of their products. You've been dealing with the whole issue of biotechnology, particularly BGH. Explain BGH.
Yes, BGH was the first genetically engineered food product to be forced on the consumers in the United States. The FDA legalized its use in February of 1994. And in spite of the fact that every poll that's ever been done in the U.S. shows 90% of consumers want to know if the dairy products they're consuming have come from cows that have been shot up with this drug, the Monsanto Corporation has managed to prevent any labeling of RBGH products, or in fact, any labeling of genetically engineered foods and crops, of which there's now 33 on the market in the U.S.
We're going to continue this discussion of the two companies that are now, if approved, merging, American Home Products and Monsanto. And if they do become one, it is the largest drug company merger in the history of this country. We're talking with three people who have worked on the other side of these companies. Ronnie Cummings, National Director of the Pure Food Campaign, is speaking to us from Minnesota. Paul Reingold is an attorney who is suing American Home Products for its products extract fenfen. And James Turner is a Washington-based attorney who wrote the book The Chemical Feast, particularly has focused on the drug and on the food product NutraSweet that is made by Monsanto. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we discuss this largest merger in drug company history, the merger of Monsanto Corporation with American Home Products. Among them, they make Advil painkillers, Centrum vitamins, NutraSweet, the pesticide Roundup. Monsanto is perhaps the largest industry in the world dealing with biotechnology. Our guest, Ronnie Cummings, National Director of the Pure Food Campaign, a public interest advocacy group that focuses on food safety, speaks to us from Minnesota. Paul Reingold on the line with us in New York has been suing American Home Products around its diet pill fenfen. Thousands of people around the country are suing American Home Products. And we're joined by Paul Reingold, Ronnie Cummings, and James Turner. James Turner, what about this merger? What are your thoughts on this? I mean, in the last months, we have reported on I don't know how many largest mergers in world and U.S. history.
Well, it's been predicted since the early 80s that we were in a stage where the corporate form is under enormous pressure, and in many ways, out of defense, these companies are merging with each other. It's not only the kind of social pressure that the lawsuits are bringing. It was interesting, earlier this year, the Church of England sold all of its stock in Monsanto, making a statement that they thought that genetically engineered food was morally reprehensible. And the kind of social pressure that's building on these companies is forcing them into what I consider to be defensive acts. What's fascinating to me is that the business press never reports the negative reasons, the bad things that are happening to these companies that are forcing them to connect up like this. At $34 billion purchase price, which looks really, really large, just remember that's smaller than the personal fortune of Bill Gates. These people are moving from industrial-based companies, and they're trying desperately to get into the information marketplace, and they're actually looking around trying to figure out how to make good with what they have. One of the main problems Monsanto had that forced it into this particular course of action is it just didn't have the cash to develop the products that it has. The negative side for the public is that there are many, many drugs in the pipeline from the Cereal Drug Company, which also, by the way, was having terrible difficulties when it merged with Monsanto back in 85. These drugs are there without the cash to develop them, and they hope that they're going to get it from American Home Products. I expect that there will be some tightening up of regulation and make it more difficult for these products to make it to the market over the next few years. But I think that the social battle is going to continue, and what they've tried to do is to create a stronger force on the side of pushing these products out without regulation. It's going to be a continuing struggle, but I think that they are, at least in part, doing this defensively.
I'd like to ask Ronnie Cummings. We've had, on Democracy Now!, several shows dedicated to the FDA's new proposed standards for organic foods and got immense response from the public. Could you talk a little bit in terms of what the public perception or viewpoint? I mean, I haven't heard of too many polls that ask the American people, what do you think about about foods that depend on biotechnology or engineering to be produced. What's your sense of what's going on in the heartland of America in response to this continued intrusion of the chemical companies into our food supply?
Well, I think in general the public is somewhat troubled and anxious about the fact that large chemical companies are now starting to covertly genetically engineer our food supply. The suspicion of the public is fueled further by the fact that it's clear that the Clinton administration and the Bush administration before them have worked hand-in-hand with Monsanto and other companies to make sure that consumers don't have a choice in the marketplace. That is, unless you're going out there and buying organic food, you can't tell that there's genetically engineered ingredients in your food. The last poll, national poll that's been done of U.S. consumers was in February of 1997. This poll was carried out by the genetic engineering and pharmaceutical company Novartis, which is based in Switzerland but has tremendous holdings in the U.S. as well. This poll found that 94% of American consumers said they wanted genetically engineered foods to be mandatorily labeled so that they could make their choice in the marketplace. The latest poll published, for example, on Monsanto's controversial bovine growth hormone found that 74% of the public feel this is a dangerous drug. And again, it was 93% that said that all genetically engineered milk, dairy, and beef products should be labeled. So all polls over the past 10 years have basically showed the same thing in the U.S. as well as the entire industrialized world, that 80 to 95% of the public want these products labeled so that they can choose to purchase them or, you know, more likely choose to not purchase them in the marketplace. And the head of Asgro Seed Company, which is a Monsanto subsidiary, the CEO, I think he put it best when he said, hey, labeling genetically engineered foods in America is the equivalent of painting a skull and crossbones on them. So the bottom line is that the large corporations and the American government and its regulatory agencies recognize full well that the only way to push this controversial new technology forward is to basically take away consumer choice in the marketplace, and that is what they have done. Last Wednesday in Washington, D.C., a broad coalition sued the FDA, basically stating that the government must start to require labeling and proper safety testing of genetically engineered foods and products before they're forced out onto the marketplace.
What about the whole issue of control of information? I mean, we've seen it with Monsanto over and over again. Suits against companies, for example, even like Ben & Jerry's, that wanted to say that their products were BGH-free. Simply that the cows were not injected with BGH. And they and other companies were sued by Monsanto, which said that, you know, as you were saying, that suggested that there was something wrong with it, that they wouldn't be able to say that. We know, just looking up on the internet last night, a German activist put up some information that was critical of Monsanto on the internet, got a call from Monsanto's lawyers 3 days later. This has happened all over the country, all over the world, in fact. When you have this kind of merger happening, an even more powerful corporation, American Home Products, I know them because at the Democratic Convention, I went to one of the parties that they held for hailing Democratic women Congress members. And there they were, all the Congress members, many Congress members were there, big celebration, big buffets. They were giving out American Home products like Centrum, like Advil, etc. And when I went around at that corporate party asking the Democratic Congress members and the people who'd been invited, well, how do you feel about being feted by this very powerful corporation? They said, this is how the system works. We don't like it, but this is how it is. And American Home Products tried to escort me out for raising the issue of them. I continually asked about Norplant at that time, the controversial contraceptive that so many women have complained they cannot get out of their arms. It's implanted in a woman's arm for 5 years, and women, particularly in the third world, once they have it in, they find it very difficult to get it out. But what about this power of these corporations over the information flow?
Jim? Well, it's one thing you should also note is that Monsanto was one of the five companies that President Clinton named in the State of the Union address as one of the best companies in America. And the president of Monsanto has been very closely associated with a bunch of things that Clinton has done, even though he ostensibly is a Republican, or was a Republican at least. The information strategies that have been used by Monsanto have, in the NutraSweet area and every area they've been involved in, have been very similar to those used by the tobacco industry. We have a number of scientists, probably 15 around the country, who have spoken out about NutraSweet with very serious, good studies, every one of which has been visited in one way or another by Monsanto with either an inducement or a threat, and have been forced essentially not to be able to continue their activity on the NutraSweet issue. This is also the whole approach of the company has been, if a lawsuit is filed, they will land on people with an enormous, enormous force and offer a very nice way of getting out of it financially. I've been questioned by the press about how many cases have been where letters have been written demanding payment and without a lawsuit being filed, and actually have been settled before they've gotten to court. It looks like a large number from the information we can get anecdotally, but these are all done with agreements that they will not be spoken about subsequently. In addition to that, there are a number of former Monsanto employees around who are very critical of the company in private, but are under very strong non-disclosure, non-speaking agreements, so that they are not available as expert witnesses, and they're not available as people to actually speak out on the issues that they're very, very knowledgeable about internally. The whole company is a rather fascinating sociology. And one of the things that's interesting about the suit that was filed last week is that there are several scientists who are very deeply involved in the biotech world from the medical side, who see great potential for biotechnology in the medical world, who are actually complaining that Monsanto's use of biotechnology in food with no regulation and no serious examination of the benefits and the risks is threatening the potential for biotechnology as a new medical medical tool. I think that's a very important aspect of what's going on here. The people at Monsanto are not interested generally in the social bottom line. They are only interested in the dollar bottom line, and they make up stories continuously to make it look as if the money that they're going to be making is all being serviced in some kind of good social purpose, when in fact those arguments don't hold up.
I'd like to ask Paul Reingold and James Turner also, how do you perceive any differences between the way the Clinton administration has handled these issues versus the prior Republican administrations of Bush and Reagan? Do you see any a partial difference in their approach or strategies?
I will answer first, Paul Reingold, and I'm going to defer to Jim in a minute, because these are regulatory questions, and having listened in on this very interesting discussion, I hope that your listeners have some understanding between what litigators do in the sense of we have an injured person and we're making a claim that a company was careless, and the very important role that critics have of trying to keep companies in line as far as providing information and putting safe products on the market. So Jim would be much more knowledgeable on this issue.
It's very important to understand that the core regulatory process here is, the core regulatory agency is the FDA. The FDA regulates 25 cents of every dollar spent by an average American. The commissioner of FDA, who occupied that post until now, although he's been gone for a year and there's been nobody in the post, was a person that was appointed in the Republican administration. David Kessler, he's got a wonderful gold-plated image in the public now because of his work on tobacco. On the other hand, he was doing a number of things during the early part of his administration, such as making sure that fresh wasn't used improperly on the on orange juice cans and so forth, that diverted the public's attention from the fact that without even a serious examination, his administration adopted a broad brush regulation that allowed genetically engineered foods to arrive on the market with no prior regulatory responsibilities. They treated it as if it was Luther Burbank grafting a pear limb on an apple tree. So there is no regulatory framework at all for genetically engineered foods to reach the market. They just come on the market as if you planted a seed in your backyard. In addition to that, then the bovine growth hormone issue came through, And I, in the conversation earlier, we discussed Monsanto's attitude about information, but it's very important to point out that the FDA regulation itself put a tremendous burden on anybody who wanted to say that they were producing dairy products without using bovine growth hormone. It was actually a violation of federal law if you did not do it with a disclaimer.
James Turner, is it true you're not allowed on the premises of Monsanto?
Yeah, it's very funny. I was a consultant on a case that was brought against Monsanto on NutraSweet, and it came time to do some discovery on records, and they moved thousands and thousands of documents out of the buildings at Monsanto over to a hotel for the express purpose of keeping me from going on the Monsanto, and it's actually the Cyril subsidiary grounds. In addition to that, I was approached by some intermediaries to have a conversation with the upper leadership of Monsanto, and I said, sure, I'd be delighted. The next thing I know, I got a letter from the Monsanto lawyers telling me that they did not want me to in any way converse with the with anybody at Monsanto, even if they wanted to do it. Interestingly enough, there were no cases pending at that time which I was involved in any way, so that even the specious notion that I shouldn't be allowed to talk to the leaders of Monsanto if they wanted to talk to me was not appropriate at that point.
Paul Reingold, at what stage now are the Fen-Phen suits? Are you already in discovery or taking depositions? Because if you are, you might be coming up with a lot more interesting information as the obviously as much of the tobacco litigation has shown.
Yes, we're moving along at various speeds in various states, and also the federal cases are moving along in a combined way down in Philadelphia. But some of the earliest discovery where actually the records have been seen and the scientists of American Home have been questioned is going on in Texas. And at least according to reports that we're getting from the Texas lawyers, there are a lot of smoking gun documents in the files of Wyeth, that is American Home, although they haven't been released yet because they're under protective orders. But the issue is really whether American Home scientists were aware of the valve damage that the product was causing before it was announced last summer, leading to the withdrawal. And we've already discovered that a very similar drug in Europe was causing similar damage, which American Home and also Interneuron, the sponsor of the drug in the United States, was aware of. So we think we have a relatively simple case to prove notice and knowledge on the part of Wyeth and failure to give a warning to the doctors who are prescribing the drug.
Well, on that note, we do have to wrap up, but I want to give out some phone numbers if people want to get in touch with each of you. Paul Reingold, if people are concerned about Fen-Phen, where can they call?
I'll give you my 1-800 number, which is 349-0004.
That's 1-800-349-0004. Ronnie Cummings, the Pure Food Campaign in Northern Minnesota.
Yes, for people who have access to the Internet, our website is www.purefood.org, all lowercase letters, and they can call our 800 number, 1-800-253-0681, and make arrangements for us to send them out some information.
That's 1-800-253-0681. And James Turner, I'm not sure if there's a number you wanted to give out.
Yeah, sure. There's we have an 800 number also. It's 1-800-510-0151.
That's 1-800-510-0181.
0151.
0151. Thank you all very much for joining us. Also, I want to let our listeners know, unfortunately, we were not able to get in touch with Lori Berenson's parents, who are outside of President Clinton's address now up at MIT. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology will let you know what happened with that protest on Monday, as they're concerned about the fate of their daughter in a Peruvian prison. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hee Soo Koo and Jeremy Scahill. Bill O'Neill, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.